Welcome to issue 4 of Behind the Panels, the only comic book podcast that's even more powerful under a yellow sun. I'm one of your co-hosts, Richard Gray.
And I'm the other co-host, David McVeigh. How are you, Richard?
Even more powerful, David.
I always wondered where that power came from.
Yeah, it's, you should see me under a red sun. Not as good.
No. Under a red sun, we lose all our powers. We become Absolutely. Mere mortals.
And I was a little annoyed at that one Christmas you gave me kryptonite.
But I thought you liked red kryptonite. It wasn't the green stuff.
It's the pink kryptonite that gets me going.
All right, so for those who are new to this little mess that we call a show,
run.
This is our fourth issue of Behind the Panels, which is, how would you best describe this, Richard? This is a podcast for comic enthusiasts, definitely.
Well, I think you described it best in the first episode, and I've come to embrace this now. It's Oprah's Reading Club for Nerds. and I objected to that at first, but I think that's how I want to represent myself to the world now.
But only half the show is that.
We just sort of wax lyrical about all things comics.
Absolutely.
For the first half of the show, and then we take a featured comic and we talk about that in detail, spoilers and all, for the second half of the show.
And I think we should stress that straight off the bat, that we do talk spoilers and all in this show. This is you can't really get in depth and deep unless you are willing to talk about everything. So
absolutely,
when we talk on this show, just consider it all spoilers. But in particular, on our pick of the week, on our comic of choice that we talk about in great detail, it will be spoilers and all. That's why we tell you the week in advance what we're going to do. That yes. way you have a chance to read it and you can kind of talk along with us, although not in the room.
That's true. You know, I've forgotten to do, David. I don't even know if we've chosen one for next week yet, but let's work that out as we go along.
Yeah, well, we'll think about that.
Yeah.
I've got a whole bunch of Superman comics that I am dying
That's true.
To dig into, so we could choose one of those.
I think I've got one in mind that we should do, but let's go ahead.
Anyway. All right, we'll keep going. And for this week, though, we are, as we said last week, doing Batman Cacophony, which is the Kevin Smith scripted, Walter Flanagan drawn comic book, 3-issue comic series, basically a Joker story, but one that's slightly different. It's not your Killing Joke style Joker. It's a very different kind of Joker, but we'll come back to that in the second half of the show. Before we do all of that, though, Richard, I think we should talk a little bit about what's been going on in the comic book world.
Absolutely.
So I'm looking through these rough show notes that you've given me here, and you've got new stuff out. Got anything new?
Well, we're recording this on a Thursday night here in Australia, which is about Wednesday in the US, so it is New Comic Book Day. I'm guessing issue 3s of a whole lot of comics are coming out.
Oh, please tell me Aquaman.
Sorry, Aquaman is out today.
Oh, yay.
I'm going to admit I'm a little bit behind. I've been catching up on films this week, although I did just watch a movie that was based on a comic book that only came out earlier this year. It's called Gantz. It's a Japanese film.
Right.
And it's based on a long-running manga. It's been running for about 300-odd issues. And it's really, really good. It's kind of like The Matrix meets The meets Cube meets... let's just leave it as Matrix meets Cube for the moment.
You can't think of another one, huh?
I did have another one, but I've forgotten it completely.
Oh, no, Aquaman didn't come out today. Damn.
No, it's not made Aquaman. Aquaman doesn't enter into it at all.
No, I'm talking about the new comics coming out. So that's not one of the ones for today. That must be later in the month. Damn. I can't believe I'm saying that I'm actually eager to read Aquaman.
And I think that's the most surprising thing about the new 52, you know? It's there are books that I never would have touched in a million years that I'm suddenly finding the most brilliant things in the world.
And there are still books that I wouldn't touch in a million years.
Men in Black, by the way, is the other reference there. So it's like Cube meets Men in Black meets The Matrix.
Thank you.
There you go.
So what was it like?
It was pretty good, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah. No, I thought, you know, fans of Gantz will know the comic books. They'll know the manga. There was an anime as well back in the early 2000s. And the films came out as live-action films. earlier this year, and they did the really unusual thing of actually simulcasting the premiere of the debut run of the film in the US a week before Japan, and they simulcasted across 46 states in about 300 cinemas. So I think it may have been a dubbed version, but still, it was an unusual move for a Japanese film. So it gives you an idea of that this does have a bit of a following
Did you
already
see this as part of the film festival?
I am seeing it as part of the Japanese Film Festival here in Sydney, and they're playing the sequel to it, which they filmed back-to-back. So, and it sort of it made me think, I think, in a later episode, perhaps one not too far off, we should definitely do some manga along the way there.
Well, we've talked that we might actually put up Akira at one point as our pick.
But where do we start?
Exactly. I mean, it's 8 or 9 issues, and each issue is like hundreds of pages. Yeah. So we're going to have to put aside some extra time for that one.
So that'll be an extra long special episode.
Yeah. Now, when we're talking about the New 52 before, I think we need to clarify something.
Yes.
I have no idea. Oh, wait a minute. I think Adam West.
Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
Thank you, Adam. Yes, absolutely. we have for 3 issues now talked about the fact that we couldn't figure out the chronology.
It turns out we're idiots.
The chronology of Justice League, and we're saying we don't understand where it fits in. They don't seem to know each other. What's going on? And today I'm looking at it again. I mean, this is only like the 12th time I've looked at Justice League, and right there on the front page it says 5 years earlier.
Rookie mistake.
Yeah, I don't know how we missed that.
No.
In all the excitement of reading Justice League, we may have missed it, but I don't know. On repeat viewings, we found the woman in red, but we didn't see the 5 years earlier.
And she's significantly smaller.
Yeah. So anyway, so that another mystery solved. So that does now fit within the chronology. So now if we look at it, we can actually now say that Justice League falls right in the middle of Superman and Action Comics, because Action Comics is 10 years earlier. Justice League is 5 years earlier.
I still find the whole thing confusing, but look, at least we know where it all fits now.
Yeah, exactly. And I have a feeling that Justice League may catch up.
Yeah, they're probably this whole lot of interest. I think because they are sort of ostensibly rebooting the whole universe in a way. They do have to have something that's kind of the origin of these characters, but at the same time they recognize that people who are existing readers really need to keep the ball rolling with the current continuity. So they've kind of tried to find a nice balance there. I was sort of, when I was preparing for this week's reading assignment for this week, I was rereading some of the Green Arrow issues that the character that turns up in Batman Cacophony first appeared in. Mm-hmm. And there was a character in there called Connor Hawke, which was Green Arrow's son. He seems to have disappeared in the New 52, so I'm hoping he turns up somewhere as well. seem to have done, because they've got younger versions of some characters and older versions of others, people that they've met along the way that we've kind of grown to love. Hopefully they haven't disappeared completely. Hopefully they will reappear somewhere in the new 52.
Or this is their opportunity to cut off some of the dead weight.
Yeah, exactly right.
I am curious. I'm not going to, in this particular situation, I'm not going to give any spoilers because I know you haven't read it yet. But I've just got to tell you that the last panel of issue 3, Green Lantern, is a shocker.
Oh, okay.
And it was like, pardon?
So is he brown?
No.
Okay, so he's not Brown Lantern now. That
no,
is a reveal.
No, no.
Takes off his mask and he's actually, no, I'm sorry, I've given up the whole green thing.
No, not quite. It's actually a little bit more shocking than that. Okay. I don't know what they're going to do with it. I don't know where they're going to go with this. I don't know how they're going to get out of it, but you know, it is comic books and they often do get out of it.
He hasn't got fingers anymore, so he can't wear the ring.
Wasn't there actually a character like that in Green Lantern at one point?
I remember Michael Bendis actually saying when he left Ultimate Spider-Man, what he wanted to do was just, he said, my final issue, I wanted to cut off Spider-Man's arms and legs, hand him to the next character and hand him to the next writer and say, you deal with it.
Sort of thing Mark Millar would do.
Yeah.
Now, as usual for this show, it's almost become a tradition. My son is actually sitting here as audience, but he has a little bit of news as well that he wanted to share with us. We actually put a post up about this on geekactually.com a little while ago, but I think it's fair to mention it again now because it is getting closer. But the, what is it? The Marvel, no, what's it called? The series?
The Lego Superheroes.
The Lego Superheroes series is about to come out. So if you're a Lego fan and a comic book fan, This is awesome. They're releasing a whole bunch of sets, and if you go online, you can actually find pictures of all the characters laid out. Marvel and DC characters. It's cross the what is it? So it's bipartisan, and it's basically these sets of all of the characters. So you can get Wonder Woman Lego figures and Superman Lego figures and all the villains, and there's a Hulk and there's a Captain America. Captain America one's awesome, by the way. Can I just tell you? So I think these are awesome. And when are they supposed to be coming out?
DC ones are coming out in January.
January for DC.
And Marvel is May.
So the DC boys win again. I guess they do account for 51% of the sales in the market at the moment. So.
Absolutely.
But so I thought. I thought that was pretty awesome. Now you have an article here that we should talk about as well, which is Marvel Season 1 and Ultimates.
We've spent a fair bit of time talking about DC, so I thought it was only fair that we'd have a few Marvel stories this week as well.
I think so.
Marvel are actually doing their own kind of rebooty type, not reboot actually, they're doing a bit of an origin thing next year called Season 1, which is not a reboot, so sorry, scrap that completely. It's actually, it's designed to attract new readers, but it's kind of like these large graphic novels, which they're calling Season 1, which is effectively like what DC did with Year 1.
Right.
And they've taken Fantastic Four, X-Men, Daredevil, and Spider-Man, and they're going to sort of reintroduce these characters to a new generation with new writers and just retell the origin stories. But they've sort of gone with the original design. So in the case of Daredevil, he's yellow. And in the case of X-Men, they're wearing the yellow spandex costumes that they wore.
So Daredevil's going back to the costume.
And Beast looks like he did back in, you know, the 60s and stuff like that. Haven't retconned them or anything.
Can I just interrupt for a second and basically say that, once again, Marvel is behind the power curve. Now, I'm a Marvel boy. Well, was a Marvel boy. It's funny because I talk about DC so much now, but I was a Marvel boy. But I got to tell you, they don't do this very well.
They don't, but this isn't sort of the news that I was sort of wanting to think that this is what they're actually doing this, and the Season 1 isn't that exciting in and of itself, but what they are doing is with the digital comics. Now, we mentioned last issue that they're finally going to do day and date comics mm-hmm. by the beginning of next year, or by early next year anyway, which is catching up with what DC is doing already in digital form.
Yep.
What they're doing now is they're actually, with each Season 1 graphic novel, and each graphic novel is going to be a sizable thing, they're actually going to include a free digital copy of the story via a shrink-wrapped code that lets you download it. And they're not just limiting it to that, they're also doing it with a bunch of their Ultimate comics next year as well.
So it's kind of like getting a digital copy and a DVD.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or when you sometimes buy a vinyl record, now you can actually they give you like an MP3 download as well. So it's kind of like getting the old school thing and having a new school version to tote around as well. So I like that idea. I really think that's a good thing, because it might encourage people who are traditionalists to check out the digital forms, which, as we said last week, don't rub off on your fingers.
That's true.
And
you notice things like 5 years earlier.
5 years earlier, exactly. And you can read it. And look, you know, for collectors, I think there's an advantage to having the digital copy as well. Like, you know, if you're a little bit anal like me, you'll get the comic, you'll back and board it off in its little box, and then you won't want to touch it again. until it's accumulated enough value for you to not sell it, but gloat about the fact that you've got this really rare issue.
So I guess you don't want me coming over with like a bag of hot greasy chips and eat those, yeah, and then go in and read your comics.
Pretty much. You would do that. But then you've got the digital copy and you can use that as your reading copy. So if it comes free with it, it's kind of like getting a free reading copy. That's the really collectory version of it. The more practical reason is attracting new readers to the digital form, because I think that's where DC and Marvel will be focusing their attention over the years. I mean, it may come a time where the physical copies are only going to be available in very small print runs for those collectors. And you know, there may be a day where physical copies just go completely.
I have a feeling it's coming, actually. The reading experience on something like the Marvel or the DC app is actually a really nice reading experience. Mm.
Now, look, my only problem with it is I'm a collector by nature.
Yeah, me too.
And I love the physical comics for a number of reasons. One of the things I actually loved doing was going back through comics from the 60s and 70s, because when I was back collecting, when I was getting back issues of some of my favorite characters and reading some of the letters pages from those. And that was great. And when they dropped the letters pages from a lot of the books, I was devastated because I thought, well, there goes a little piece of history. And, you know, and you look back and it's kind of like you can see all these people who might still be fans of the comic. Some of them are just, you know, are no longer fans. But even there are some comic book creators who had their first things technically published in a DC comic or a Marvel comic back in the letters pages when they were a 12-year-old
writing in. Marvel Bullpen was always one of my favorite sections of the comic book. It was fantastic.
So I like that stuff like that, and I like you know, picking up these old comics, particularly a lot of the old comics you get now or possibly secondhand, or, you know, you think the journey this comic has had to get to you now. And I think that's a little bit special, and, you know, I'm a little bit traditionalist in that sense, but by the same token, I think the digital copies are great. But I worry about future longevity of them. What happens when the format you've downloaded them in becomes superseded?
I've said that about the digital world. When we were talking on Geek Actually once, I was talking about this with games and with music and everything else. There is something to be said about having a physical copy of something. Mm. I think the digital copy is too ethereal. It's too, you know, it's just. Mm. It's too easy just to delete as well.
Absolutely. Accidentally be deleted, yeah.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. One hard drive crash and everything's gone. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, let's face it, the iPad is probably not the most stable of archival places to hold.
Well, no, and I actually archive everything on my Mac itself, and I only put stuff onto my iPad as I need it. You know what I mean? So
look, everything, all the important stuff are in, you know, is in these three places, and it's also in the cloud for me as well. But you know, I things like that. You know, I can just imagine it coming to a time where thinking, "Geez, I wish I had a physical copy of that." But oh well. but I just think it's a really interesting thing. But by the same token, DC, who are already on top of this whole digital comic thing, have announced that they're with some of their comics, including I think it's Batman Beyond Unlimited.
Yep.
And the Batman Beyond and Justice League Beyond monthly print publications. But they're actually going to do a digital first thing as well with it. So not only are they coming out digital day and date, but in these particular ones, you'll get them first on digital.
That's an interesting move. That's a really interesting move, because that's kind of, it's almost like dipping their toe in the water to see if that works.
Yeah.
To see if it would sell or float or fly as just a digital copy first.
And the Batman Beyond Unlimited is going to be a 48-page monthly book as well. So that's quite a substantial thing to put out there. It's not part of the main DCU, so it's kind of like a special thing, I guess.
Hmm.
But still, I think I like the idea, because maybe it rewards people, you know, who get the digital, and, you know, DC may have found a way to sell things twice to people who still want the digital, who want the print copy of the book, but they also want to read it as soon as possible, so they get the digital and then they go and buy the physical copy a week later or whenever it comes out. You know, I think it's a clever idea.
Absolutely.
And, so DC are once again kind of leading the way with not only in the digital thing, but also in their the way they're structuring their books at the moment. So kudos where it's due.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk about you've got Chris Claremont has donated his archives to Columbia.
Oh, look, very quickly. Very I thought quickly. This was a really interesting story. Chris Claremont, you know, longtime Uncanny X-Men writer, you know, amongst other things, but he apparently donating his archives to Columbia University's Rare Book and Manuscript Library, and this is coming from Comic Book Resources. I grabbed this story. And he said the collection includes materials for all of his major writing projects over the past 40 years, notebooks with story ideas, drafts of short stories, plays, novels, and comic books and materials from his early training in the theater and his career as an actor. And somebody from Columbia University said, "We hope this is the first of more comics papers to come to the university. We want to be a magnet for these kind of archives in New York City, where the comics medium was born."
Don't you just want to go through those archives?
Oh, God, yeah.
Chris Claremont's Uncanny X-Men from that era, was my favorite era of Uncanny X-Men.
It's some excellent stuff, and I think we should definitely choose one of the story arcs for that for one of our future episodes.
I think if we go back, he was probably pretty heavily involved in the Dark Phoenix saga. So,
oh, absolutely.
We can probably dig anywhere around that era. That's the early 80s, mid-80s stuff, which is just fantastic. It was when the X-Men were in their prime.
Yeah, look, I've got some of that stuff in various collections, and they are amazing books. And obviously, a lot of the films that came out were based on
that era of comics. No, absolutely, because that was the introduction of Wolverine during that time.
Absolutely,
as well.
And the whole Phoenix thing and all that sort of stuff. Ooh. So yeah, look, it is a and Stryker and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's all gold stuff. So I would, yes, definitely love to go. Just sort of off topic slightly, Disney have their own library of their own archival materials, and that's an archive I've always wanted to go through because they've got sketches going back to the 20s.
I saw there was
they've kept everything. You know?
There was actually footage of that archive. If you go into the Tron disc and look through some of the stuff on the Tron disc, Steve Lisberger takes his son to the Disney archives, and they're going through the folders with the white cotton gloves, looking at all the early sketches and pictures and all that stuff from the 80s, from when they were actually doing Tron. And it was stuff
amazing. They've kept everything because they have this philosophy that we can always go back and learn from it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great philosophy to have.
Yeah.
I always say, learn your history. It helps you drive the future.
Absolutely.
All right, now.
Well said, though. And speaking of learning from history, I think there's one more story we should touch on before we move on to movie news.
Yeah, look, Frank Miller.
Enough said.
I'm going to read a quick quote. And this was published in Comic Book Resource, of course. But Frank Miller came out on a rant about Occupy Wall Street. His quote was basically, I'll just read you, he had several things to say, but let's just read this one quote where he says, Occupy is nothing short of a clumsy, poorly expressed attempt at anarchy to the extent that the movement, some movement, except if the word bowel is attached, is anything more than an ugly fashion statement by a bunch of iPhone, iPad-wielding, spoilt brats who should stop getting in the way of working people and find jobs for themselves. In the name of decency, go home to your parents, you losers. Go back to your mama's basements and play with your Lords of Warcraft, or better yet, enlist for the real thing. Maybe our military could whip some of you into shape.
Yeesh.
Yeesh. First of all, I want to say Lords of Warcraft.
Yeah, I know. Now, I've got to say, one of the best responses to this was from Ty Templeton, who did a Frank Miller Funnies edition of his Bun Toons webcomic.
Right.
And the comic is, if you can find this online, it's great.
I'm seeing it right now, yeah.
It's the bunny interviewing Frank Miller, who quite literally has his head stuck up his rear end. and it says, it was an oddly out-of-touch moment to tie the war on terror to a cliched list of old-school anti-hippie slurs. Frank Miller says, so I'm wondering if maybe your view of the world didn't get a little frozen in amber the day you decided to stick your head up your ass. Now, well said, Mr. Templeton.
Yeah, absolutely.
But interestingly enough, he's not the only person to have come out and said, a lot of people have responded to this, and including, just fans of both Miller and people who aren't fans of Miller. But one person who did respond to it was comic creator Mark Miller, who is very much at the opposite end of the political spectrum.
I guess just for those who aren't real familiar, we should state Frank Miller is the creator of 300 and The Dark Knight Returns, amongst many other things. Sin City, he's been...
Some of the best Daredevil runs.
Some of the best Daredevil. He created Elektra. He's a fantastic comic writer.
But don't blame him for the movie. That's not his fault.
No, but we can blame him for the spirit.
We can very much blame him for the script.
which he directed. And he's a really, really talented comic book creator. Better writer than artist, I think, but still a great
comic
book.
And he's got a new one out in the last month or so called Holy Terror, which looks very, the art and the look of it looks very much like 300 in that kind of widescreen format.
I'd like to see
it. But it's meant to be his response to 9/11. So.
Ooh, okay. I actually had no idea, funnily enough, until this rampage, that he was so right-wing. I didn't realize he was such a right-wing whack job.
You'd read Dark Knight. Batman Returns.
Yeah, but, you know, somebody can create a character like that and not actually be a right-wing nut.
That's true.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I thought it was a great piece of writing, but it actually kind of brings the... it actually kind of brings the writing into question, doesn't it? Because it is just
absolutely.
It's just a rampage, basically. You know,
You know, he did refer to the Occupy protesters as a pack of louts, thieves, and rapists.
Yeah.
Now, it was interesting that Mark Miller did come out in defence of Frank Miller.
And Mark Millar, for those who don't know, is the guy who created Kick-Ass
and the old. Series as well.
And the Ultimate Series, and he also did Nemesis.
Yes.
Which apparently Tony Scott has optioned for a film, by the way, so I'd be very curious about that. But yeah, now he's an interesting writer. I don't think he's... Oh, he also did the Wanted.
Yes, of course.
But not the movie, which is completely different to the comic book. Actually, there's a comic book series we should do.
Absolutely. Write that down, David.
We'll write that down. That's an interesting one. We keep a list, guys. You got any more suggestions, throw them into comics@geekactually.com.
Please. Now, it's interesting. Like, his response was very, very typical of the left wing, but it's a response I agree with. He said, it's strange to what... your favorite writer getting strips torn off him for a couple of days. Politically, I disagree with his analysis, but that's beside the point. I wasn't shocked by his comments because they're no different from a lot of commentators I've seen discussing the subject. What shocked me was the vitriol against him, the big bucket of shit poured over the head by even fellow comic book creators for saying what was on his mind. Then, you know, one of the commenters actually said, you know, if you throw the first bucket of shit, then you should be prepared for some splashback. Now,
just a fellow comic book creators, there was one here, which is Batgirl writer Gail Simone.
That's right.
Actually said, frankmillerinc.com is a great link if you like absolute bullshit. You know?
Yeah.
I think that's what
Miller was objecting to was what he called the distasteful cyber mob mentality.
I agree, and I completely agree with him.
Yeah, and we've seen this. Look, if you're a netizen like we are, you've been to countless forums, chat rooms, Twitter feeds, Facebook, whatever, where it's been a comment made and everyone just jumps on it and pounds the person for even having made that comment in the first place. Regardless, you know, if they don't agree with it, you're wrong, you're stupid. Rather than just sort of saying, okay, disagree with you, but here's my opposing view. Thank you very much. So the internet seems to be this... there doesn't seem to be any filtering on the internet, which is not what we want. But I mean, I'm talking about self-filtering.
No, it's also the mentality of anonymity as well, which is people just get in there and throw
anyone
stuff
can
out.
Be a dog on the internet order.
Absolutely, anybody can say anything because there seems to be no repercussions. These are people who would never say these things in public.
Mm.
They would never go out in the middle of a street and, you know, turn around and say half the things that they say in forums because people can see them.
But the flip side of this, of course, is that Frank Miller has come out and said something publicly. And, you know, people have used their right as netizens to respond to that in an equally public forum because they don't have the same voice that Frank Miller has. They don't have that large-scale platform that he's developed from, you know, 20, 30 years writing in comics. So, and films, of course. Don't forget Frank Miller wrote two of the RoboCop films. You know, for better or for worse.
he also wrote and co-directed Sin City, you know, and it's like, Frank Miller is.
And the spirit.
Yeah, well, I've already told you, I'm not forgiving him for that one.
we're keeping it balanced.
Look, I think when it comes down to, what it really comes down to is the problems with a country that has a freedom of speech is sometimes people are going to say things you don't like. All right.
That's right.
And you have to deal with it. That's one of the joys of freedom of speech. It's also one of the problems with freedom of speech. Mm. This is why we can have people like your Fox Entertainment News ranters like O'Reilly and so forth get up there and basically just lie and say whatever they want to say because they are protected by freedom of speech. They can say whatever they want. They've got their own opinions. We're not going to like it. If you don't like what they're saying, don't listen. You know,
I don't even like half the things you're saying, David.
Well, absolutely, you very rarely listen to me.
So. I will fight for your right to say them.
So I look at this and I go, I disagree with almost everything that Frank Miller is saying. I take that back. I agree with some of the points that he's making because I actually do think the Occupy thing is kind of going a little bit out of control. And this is a political thing and we can get into arguments about it and so forth. I think we
should... So stay tuned for politics, actually.
I've thought about it. But look, and the bottom line is this, though. whether I agree with what they're doing or not, it is their right to be able to protest.
Absolutely.
And it is his right to basically have an opinion on their protest. And absolutely. And we have to basically say, if we give them the right to protest, and we also give him the right to protest. It's as simple as that.
And I thought it was an interesting little story, particularly it was Miller commenting on Miller, and I think it's even in the world of comics, you may think they're frivolous things, but there are some very interesting political forces at play.
I think comics are not given enough credit for the politics that they get.
Oh, look, you know, I particularly during the 80s when Frank Miller was writing things like The Dark Knight Returns and so forth, there was more comments on, you know, the sort of Reagan era of the US in that than anywhere in popular culture.
And let's go back to that era of the X-Men. The X-Men was all about intolerance and about racism.
Absolutely.
Bigotry. You know, that's what it was about. And it was
Marvel
all
in the 60s was the civil rights movement, you know.
Absolutely.
It was very much.
So yeah. I think there's a lot to be said about a lot of things that the comics have to say. You just got to dig, because some of them are kind of frivolous, but others really have a point to make. I think Batman The Dark Knight Returns, Frank Miller's back, is a powerful piece of writing.
And we definitely have to do that one in a future issue.
We've got a big list, people.
Very big list. We're going to be around for a while.
So we've got a long way to go. All right. I think we've got a little bit of
movie news. That's right. It's movie news time. So the first thing we've got to talk about, we mentioned this before, is I, Frankenstein. Which
it's going to shoot in Melbourne, you said, isn't it?
It's going to shoot in Melbourne.
Yep.
And it's that's Melbourne, Australia, for those of you who might be confused.
Melbourne.
Melbourne.
by the way, I used to come. I came from Melbourne. So. Well, actually, I came from California, but I lived in Melbourne for a long time.
That's a strong Melbourne accent you're rocking there.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
And, you know, look, I, Frankenstein was by Kevin Grievous, as I've now found out his name is pronounced.
I love that. Can I just say, what's his first name?
Kevin.
Kevin. I think from now on, when I watch the prequel trilogy of Star Wars, I'm going to have to call General Kevin Grievous.
Kevin. I want to see that someone just dubbed the whole thing.
And Obi-Wan going, you can't do it, Kevin.
Oh, absolutely.
I think we've got a new meme ready to go. we've just lost my son, by the way.
Internet superstars by the end of the week, Dave. But I, Frankenstein, which we already announced, was already been long announced as it's a comic book. It's the Kevin is the creator of Underworld, for those of you not familiar with his previous works. He did I, Frankenstein, which is kind of like a modern noirish sort of book with Frankenstein as his lead character.
Yep.
Frankenstein's monster as his lead character. I have to get that right.
What is it with using Frankenstein as a comic book character at the moment?
I don't know. Yeah, because there's Frankenstein,
Agent of Shade in the New 52. Yeah. It's like, and that was introduced. I don't know if there was a Frankenstein comic prior to Flashpoint, but there was a comic in Flashpoint all about Frankenstein as well.
Yeah, no, I think there was a comic prior to that, but for some reason, that was he was one of the people that survived the New 52.
It's very strange. So, I have not been able to get through the comic.
I don't think it's going to last much longer. But, I've not read much of it, so I can't say whether it's good or bad. The first issue was okay. I thought it was kind of fun, but I can't see myself reading it.
I kind of rate it up there with OMAC and Mr. Fantastic at this point. No, Mr. Terrific.
I don't think all of the New 52 will last. I think at some point it's going to be the New 47.
Yeah. Or the not-so-new 47.
We'll just call it the DCU.
So who published I, Frankenstein? Do we know?
We did originally. Hang on. I've had the article up here. It was originally published by Darkstorm Studios.
So it's an indie?
It's an indie, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Now, as we said, it was previously announced, it's going to be shot in Melbourne. Aaron Eckhart is starring in the lead role.
So he's Dr. Frankenstein or the monster?
As the monster, I think.
As the monster, okay.
As far as I know, and it's also going to be directed by Stuart Beattie, who's an Australian director who did Tomorrow When the War Began most recently.
Oh, I was not impressed by that.
Yeah, well, but The latest news is that Bill Nighy, who's in every movie, so we shouldn't be surprised that he's in this, has been offered the villain role. So,
although he's great, you know?
What was that?
He's great. I love him.
Oh, Bill Nighy's fantastic. So I'm really looking forward to having both Aaron Eckhart and Bill Nighy in the country.
Look, if there's any producers who are working on I, Frankenstein who would like to bring us down for a set visit, we'd love to come.
Yeah, look, I'm down to Melbourne a couple of times a year anyway, so I can just, you know, arrange around that.
Cool. We'll have to see what we can dig up. The next piece of news in film had me deeply, deeply disturbed.
Oh, God. The funny thing is I posted this, I think, this morning or late yesterday. It's had so many hits, but on my website, which I'll shamelessly hock at the end of the show.
Yeah.
But Christian Stewart offered a role Akira. Now, I actually, when I posted this,
you know,
on
when
my
I think
site,
of Christian Stewart's some- face, I think of this.
Wait till they get a load of me.
One of my loyal followers on Twitter goes by the handle of Geek of Oz, so one of our people.
Yep.
When I posted the story, said it seems as though the people behind Akira are saying, "What else can we do to turn fans against us?"
I agree wholeheartedly with him.
I don't think I can say anything more than that. That's a perfect.
I think that sums it up. Kristen Stewart, and what is it with? This is the girl who actually came out publicly, what, 2 years ago, saying that she didn't like being in the limelight or being a star.
Yeah.
And yet she's in how many films at the moment?
A lot.
It's like she keeps getting cast. We've got her coming out in Snow White and the Huntsman coming out soon. Although every time I hear that title, I think of a spider. I'm sorry.
I know. I was thinking the same thing.
That's a very Australian thing, I know, because I don't know if Huntsman are, you know, anywhere else
in
the world.
I don't think Huntsman spiders exist anywhere else in
the world. No, because they're just tarantulas everywhere else. You know?
They're tarantulas. Ours are kind of like ground tarantulas.
Yeah, exactly.
They live in little holes in the ground.
They like to come into your living room and sit on the wall.
But everyone around the world knows we've got the weirdest creatures.
We do. We're an island. We're isolated. We got a platypus. Yeah. It's got a duck's bill and it's got webbed feet and it's a mammal. Go for it. No,
I love that the platypus exists.
Platypus existing is proof, positive, that there is no such thing as intelligent design.
There was that one day when a duck and a wombat were playing chicken.
Well, there's that old joke where they say that God was up there and he had his box of parts and he goes, you know, I've just got these things left over. And the platypus was born, you know? You know,
it's like, yeah. Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
Oh,
you some wanna... days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
Thank there you go.
Yeah, I think we should move swiftly along.
We do, actually. We have to get away from Kristen Stewart because she gives me a headache. Now... We have good news to finish us off.
Absolutely.
We have good news to finish it off, which is The Dark Knight Rises wraps. Which means that a full trailer can't be far away.
Because my name is Bruce and I'm on that kind of rap. I'll mention that.
I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
Yeah.
So after 6 months of shooting... Yep. Or 179 days, if you're being precise.
Look, for Christopher Nolan, that is not that long.
No. He's finished principal photography on Dark Knight Rises. Although, technically speaking, production did start a little bit earlier in India. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
I think he needed to finish really fast before any more leaked footage came out.
Now, look, we don't have to wait too long for footage of this thing. Now, the movie doesn't obviously come out until July next year, but there will be a 6-minute preview attached to Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
But that's only on IMAX, isn't it?
It's only on IMAX.
Yeah. So if you go see it at IMAX, you get to see IMAX footage.
Absolutely. And now we've got to say, we saw a preview of... of about 25 minutes of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol on IMAX, and it's the way to see it.
Yeah. Look, I saw Avatar on IMAX, and I have to say I was really underwhelmed because Avatar wasn't shot in IMAX, and it was just basically projected. So it was just this film that was projected in the middle of an IMAX screen.
Big.
And it was 3D, you know, and I kind of came out going, yeah, I didn't need to pay IMAX prices for that, you know what I mean? And then I saw it in another cinema, and I actually thought the real D presentation was better than the IMAX. However, when you see something shot on IMAX, where it's floor to ceiling, whole screen, super stereo, it is amazing.
And oh no, it's like really, because I mean, I think we all know, very off topic here, we don't want to get into film too much, but something like the scene from Mission Impossible where they're abseiling down the side of the world's largest building, you can imagine floor to ceiling.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. So to see, like the second one, Dark with the Dark Knight, they shot, I think it was 20 minutes of the film on IMAX cameras. Mm. And when you actually saw it projected in IMAX, what happened is it would be a normal film playing in the middle of the screen, and when you hit those sequences, bang, it would just open up floor to ceiling, and you get those scenes. And if you've got The Dark Knight on Blu-ray, you can actually see how that works. Because
it changes aspect ratio
throughout. And every time it changes aspect ratio to be a full 16:9 without the black bars, that's the IMAX footage, right? So what they've done is the same thing with Mission Impossible. They've shot sequences in IMAX, but apparently it's like 40 minutes of the film.
Yeah, no, apparently it is. It is at least twice the amount that they did on Dark Knight. So really, really looking forward to seeing what they've done with that one. So look, I mean, comic geek, not looking forward to The Dark Knight Rises.
It's just unheard of.
Not a comic book geek at all.
Are you looking forward to Dark Knight Rises? Yeah, he's nodding.
Yeah. I suspected Nicky might be looking forward to a Batman film.
Yeah, he might be. He just might be. He was actually too young when The Dark Knight came out to see it at the cinema, because I thought it was might be just a little intense for him. But he's now...
Yeah, it would have been. It was a little too intense for me, Dave. Yeah, but he's now the perfect... It's an intense film.
He's now the perfect age.
Oh, absolutely.
And so we will go to IMAX and see Dark Knight Rises on that big screen.
I am so looking forward to
that. He also really wants to see the Mission Impossible, so we might have to go see that at the IMAX screen as well.
And Spider-Man.
That's not on IMAX, though. No. He wants to see the Spider-Man movie as well, which is also looking pretty good, too, I must say.
Next year's going to be a big year for us.
It's an awesome movie year for the comic book geek.
Avengers, of course, as well.
Oh, man. You're just making me squirm a little bit here.
Oh, yeah. So should we move on to... Oh, hang on. Look, there's one
wacky
story.
We got one thing here. That's pretty wacky.
One wacky story. It's not really a wacky story. It's actually a happy ending to a...
To something that's gone on for a long time, actually. So let's give some background. This gentleman, what's his name? It's Gary Armbrusher.
Okay.
Oh, no. That was the thief. What was his name?
Sorry, I'm bringing up the article.
Mike Meyer.
We should have been able to remember that one.
Yeah, Mike Meyer. We should have known that one. Mike Meyer is a 48-year-old mentally challenged individual who is a long-time Superman fan, and for many, many years has spent basically all of his money on collecting Superman memorabilia.
Now, we're talking according to the comic book resources article, 1,800 Superman comics, figures, and other memorabilia he'd been collecting since 1974.
It's 1974. Now, apparently what happened was this girl befriended him, and her boyfriend came to his house. This is going back a couple of months now. And she basically flirted with him. And, of course, this is taking complete advantage of this man who basically is not really in a situation to deal with this. And while she's flirting with him, her boyfriend is in stealing his entire collection of memorabilia right under his nose while he's there. And this started a massive groundswell on the internet. Basically, geeks around the world just helped out. They were all going to contribute stuff to him. They were all helping him, blah, blah, blah. The good news is that they did finally catch the person who did it, and they got back this guy's memorabilia, which is a fantastic finish. But that's not where the story ends. This is the happy ending, Richard, is what?
Well, the happy ending is the person who stole it has now been sentenced to 6 years in prison.
Yay! Justice is served
once again.
Justice is served. I don't have a justice is served ranking. Oh, well, it doesn't matter.
But I think it was a great story throughout it, though, because people from all over the world, including Australia and the UK, actually rallied to help replace a lot of his collection.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I really loved that. But then apparently he's donating, because his collection has now been recovered, which it came about in a really weird way. The police were investigating a forcible robbery of money and jewelry from a 76-year-old man. So this Armbruster was a real piece of work.
Yeah, apparently this is a technique they've been using a lot.
Yeah, and so he took the so they were investigating that, were able to recover all of his goods. So he's got, you know, all the stuff that people donated to him. Mike Meyer is now in turn donating that to charity as well. So, look, you know, I think It's a really nice win-win scenario for everyone.
I love the fact that his dogs are named Crypto and
Crypto
Dino.
And Dino.
Oh, I love that. Isn't this man a sweetheart? I love it. And you know what? He got robbed and the internet community came to his aid. So that sounds kind of like this.
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me. Who's got you?
There you go.
That's fun.
So yes. No, look, and it's just a really... This is when that mass that we were talking about, the netizen mass, actually does work.
Absolutely.
And this is when they all come together and they help each other out. And I think that's fantastic. All right. I think we need to move on.
Hark, what's that I hear, David?
Well, see how you like this.
What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's awfully funny.
It's the pick of the week.
It certainly is. And
Oh, no, go on. This week, the pick of the week we've already mentioned is Batman Cacophony.
And I have a copy of Batman Cacophony sitting right in front of me now. This is a series that was written by Kevin Smith. For those who don't know who Kevin Smith is, where have you been for the last 20 years? Kevin Smith, of course, is the writer-director of films like Clerks and Chasing Amy and Dogma and most recently Red State. He also writes comic books. And he wrote a season of Green Arrow.
Green Arrow. Well, he basically brought the original Green Arrow back from the dead in a run called Quiver back in, I think it was about 2000, 2001. And he followed that up with a show. He was only commissioned to do the first 10 issues to bring back Oliver Queen and bring him back into the DCU. But he had so much fun. He wrote a couple more issues after that. And... he wrote a short two-parter, and then he wrote this one called The Sounds of Violence. Now, The Sounds of Violence was designed to remedy something that had been a problem with Green Arrow for the longest time. He didn't really have a rogues gallery. Mm. And he introduced this character called Onomatopoeia.
Which now, I onomatopoeia.
That's how you pronounce it. Now, onomatopoeia, for those of you who remember high school English, is words that are spelt the same way they sound, like oomph, bash, yep, boom, crash, etc. Blam. Kablammy.
Blam, kablam.
So basically, any episode of the 1960s Batman, that's onomatopoeia you're seeing all throughout that. So he in this series, he introduced the character of Onomatopoeia, who was a character who just wore a very plain mask and a trench coat, who was going around killing fledgling superheroes. And he basically, if he was about to shoot someone, he'd say bam, and then he'd actually fire his gun and blow their head off. Hmm. But he was a very creepy character. You never saw his face. You never knew anything about him, and at the end of the Green Arrow run, he disappeared.
So they never actually, because in Cacophony we actually have kind of more information about that. So you didn't find out any more about him at that time.
You don't find anything about him at all.
Oh, it's interesting. Okay,
so he just disappears basically at the end, because in the Green Arrow story, he shot Green Arrow's son, Connor Hawke, mm-hmm, and he doesn't look like he's going to make it, but then he does pull through in the end. But just as Green Arrow looks like he's got him cornered on the top of the building, and Onomatopoeia lets himself fall. So Green Arrow lets him go because he wants to go back to his son, and when he goes down, he finds that Onomatopoeia is gone, and that's the last we see of him until this miniseries, Batman Cacophony, also written by Kevin Smith.
Now, I got to say, Kevin Smith is a really fine comic book writer. Say what you like about his films, and there's a lot of people who like or dislike his movies, but he's a really good comic book writer.
And I've got to say this. Look, I find the pacing of Cacophony, because I reread it. I collected this originally in the singles, and I reread it this afternoon. The pacing is almost flawless.
Yeah.
It is. He's clearly got a love for comics, and I think that's a great place to start. He's clearly got a love for the universe, because he weaves in as many characters as he possibly can. But it's a tight story, and it's a perfect. It's a 3-issue arc, and it's a perfect 3-act film in a way, or 3-act story. So it begins with Joker in Arkham Asylum.
But let's go back one step further, because it's okay, a wonderful, wonderful piece of writing that starts the story off, which is quite literally somebody breaking into Arkham. But
that's true.
With that person breaking in, there is a story being told just in like the narration about how during a nationwide economic crash and cost-cutting measures, the board of Arkham opted to discontinue security guards at the front gate. And it goes on, and I won't read the whole thing, but it goes on with the fact that how, you know, one of them went on to unemployment benefits, another one ran an ad, and eventually that ad finally paid off with somebody then paying him thousands of dollars for the secrets of getting into Arkham, you know, and then he wanted to go he said he's going to go, what does he say? He says,
he's going to go live in Baja, Mexico.
Live in Baja, Mexico and run a scooter, run a moped.
Yeah. Profits on booze and loose women for the remainder of his days.
I think it's it's a fabulous little narration because there's so much happening in those panels with person breaking in. And yet you're kind of torn between, am I reading the story or am I looking at these pictures of these guards being darted and this stranger coming into this panel? It's really clever. It's really, really beautifully structured. And Smith has, and you, people who have listened to film actually know that I am a fan of Smith's writing. He has a real flair with dialogue, and he writes, because comic books are essentially all dialogue, even the narration. They're speaking to the reader in a way. And so he has a real knack for that. And I think that works really well. Anyway, you were saying Joker is there.
So he's there. Joker's there. And then the first thing, he's reading a copy of Ayn Rand's Fountainhead.
I love that.
Which is a running gag throughout the series. With the line, "Lo, Floyd," we realize that the person who's been breaking in is Deadshot. Kind of token assassin sort of character, unstoppable assassin character in the DCU. Now, he's there to kill the Joker. Who has his venom toxin in a wonderful subplot? The fact that the Joker's venom has been turned into a party drug while he's been locked in Arkham Asylum, which I loved. I think it's great. and the party drug has killed a few people, so Deadshot's been hired by one of the family's victims to kill the Joker. Now, the Joker's outraged by this, that his ultimate weapon of terror has been turned into something that's, as in his words, being used people at keggers. Yeah. But just as Deadshot's about to kill the Joker, this other character turns up with the word "fush." Onomatopoeia arrives on the scene.
And once again, before we have his introduction, we should just talk about how the structure of this story, all the way through this very dialogue-heavy scene, which is quite funny at the same time, because it should be stated right at the top, Joker is insane in this one.
Yeah.
He's literally nuts. We're not even talking about Killing Joke Dark or anything. We're just talking about Looney Tunes.
you were talking before the show, David, about how he's even drawn like he's a Looney Tune rather than like the rest of them kind of have a bit of reality to him.
Absolutely.
He's the most exaggerated character in the whole thing, and it's great.
It's great. Really, it's fantastic. And I love the fact that during all of this dialogue, and the two of them are just talking to each other, and it's all very casual in the sense that, oh, yeah, I'm coming here to kill you. He's going, oh, why would you come and kill me? And there's one point where Joker's yawning as he's talking to him, and all the way through it, Deadshot, right? Deadshot is basically sticking plastic to the glass wall and wiring it up to explode. You know, it's like all the way through it, he doesn't miss a beat and getting ready to break in to kill Joker. It's very
and
good.
So look, you know, it goes on for a while, and now this results ultimately in Onomatopoeia grabbing Joker and escaping with him, allowing the Joker to escape from Arkham. Followed by
a bizarre first,
what was that?
A bizarre little scene.
A bizarre sequence which you'll probably never see in any other DC comic ever again.
No.
Where Onomatopoeia hands the Joker a bunch of cash, the Joker assumes that Onomatopoeia is a person with a clown fetish.
And wants some sexual favors. That's
and proceeds to tell him that he bottoms from the top and drops his stacks next to a tree. Now,
I love the fact that he also goes so far as to say, just do me a favor and don't tell Tedge. Yeah.
Because that midget's been trying to get me to do this for years now.
And I told him I didn't swing that way.
Now, that's very Kevin Smith.
That is. I mean, that whole scene is very Kevin Smith. I mean, also little things that are very Kevin Smith. One of just before they break out, before they leave, or actually just before Deadshot is shot, basically, the place is on fire, it's burning, he's done the C4, the whole bit. He's in Deadshot's arms, and as they're talking about, you know, Deadshot's talking to the other shooter, and Joker's just looking off at the distance, he goes, Floyd, my toilet's on fire on over there. It's like the writing is just, but they've painted this portrait of Joker of just nothing in the real world seems to be affecting him.
It's actually funny. I say it's very Kevin Smith, but in some ways it's not. It's very Joker.
Yeah.
It's the Joker is this mad character. And I think what's really great about through this, later on after Batman's introduced, and after taking down Victor Zsasz, he returns to the Batcave where he's having a conversation with Alfred, who's talking about, yes, Master Bruce, normal people like your good self.
Yeah.
You know, there's this real droll sense of humor, that there's real awareness from Alfred that they're all mad and he's just there witnessing the whole thing.
And I've got to just say about Zsasz really quickly. I mean, even the point where he has to mark the marks on his body because he cuts the marks in his body. And the fact that he's going to cut into his penis because he hasn't got any more room on his body is, once again, this is a very Kevin Smith thing to do.
Oh, they're really great. There's a great Kevin Smith line immediately after that where Batman interrupts and says, instead I crash Zsasz's unholy bris.
And then what's Batman say as he comes through the roof, though? He actually, where is it? I'm trying to find the
Barack
page.
Harvey,
that's the one.
That, and it's just little throwaway lines like that all throughout all throughout the three-part series, and it really keeps it fresh, and it keeps you on your toes throughout the whole thing. Now, a lot happens in that first issue.
There's a lot of setup here.
And one of the other things we should mention is that there's a character called Maxi Zeus, who is now a bit of a crime lord, or sort of legitimate businessman running a bit of a crime empire in Gotham, but he was previously, and now I don't know the history of this character, but apparently he used to run around as Maxi Zeus, who was like this toga wearing.
Well, what's really interesting is Maxi Zeus, I don't actually think I've ever read him in a comic book, and I'm not saying he wasn't in a comic book, but he used to be a character on the 66 Batman series.
Right.
If you remember, but I think he was referred to as King.
He's definitely in the comics.
He was referred to as King.
Actually, no, he first appeared in the comics in the late 70s, in 1979.
Oh, so no, I'm not thinking of Maxi Zeus. I'm thinking of King Tut, which was the character in the 66 series. But he was also a toga wearer. That's why I think I was getting him confused.
Right.
But that's King Tut. That wasn't Maxi Zeus. Yeah, no, it's an odd character because he quite literally is another whack job.
And he describes himself as having very public extended psychological breakdowns.
And now he's taking medication for his bipolar.
Exactly. And anyway, the Joker comes back and it's Maxi Zeus who's been muddying, who's been watering down Joker's venom into a party drug. So Joker's understandably upset with him. So he takes revenge on him by, well, this spoiler zone here. So he takes revenge on him by killing Maxi Zeus's kid.
Yeah.
By blowing up his entire school.
Well, he blows up the school that Maxi Zeus built.
Yeah, exactly,
with all
right.
The kids in it. Now, we should go back and say that Maxi Zeus was working for Joker.
He was.
The idea
was. The Joker seems to have forgotten at first.
Well, he actually says, because, you know, you had very simple instructions, which were you were supposed to put out a little bit of the venom at April 1st, which was going to bring Batman to Arkham to find
That's
out
right.
whether or not Joker was out. And then Joker was supposed to be able to look at him and say, April Fool's. Right,
but Maxi didn't stick to the plan.
And instead decided to build an empire. And I think that it's summed up where Joker actually says, "I don't want an empire, buddy. Never did. All I want, and all I ever wanted, is to have a good time and to annoy Batman whenever possible."
And it's a great line because it really ties into that. Well, one, it ties into the picture of Batman, of Joker and Batman that they've created in Christopher Nolan movies.
Yep.
Like he just wants to watch the city burn.
Yep.
But this is a much more playful Joker.
Except for the next panel when he says, and one day murder Batman and defile his carcass sexually.
And yeah, there's that as well, which is very much the theme throughout.
But I love the fact that he says, what I want is to annoy Batman whenever possible and to one day murder Batman and defile his carcass sexually and a pony.
And a pony. And I think this is a crucial component we've been missing to the Joker all these years, that really he just wanted a pony and no one bought him a pony.
Absolutely. Look, I think it's a wonderful portrayal of Joker because he really is. He is very much like the spirit of the Joker from The Dark Knight. It's yes. That whole just reign of chaos.
Absolutely. And I think this is what I mean. This comic did come out after The Dark Knight, but the portrayal of Joker isn't that different to the stuff into the 1970s and 80s. Obviously, these are probably the period of comics that Kevin Smith would have been reading as a kid.
Mm.
So it's very much a throwback to that. And his other stuff that he's written have all been throwbacks to his version of the version of the character he loved.
Yeah.
So I quite like it when the Joker's in the next issue is Maxi Zeus is now snapped completely and gone back to his toga wearing days.
And there's a great exchange of dialogue of his bodyguards.
Oh yeah, that's just fantastic.
Brilliant. What's his bodyguard say? He says, "If you're the all powerful, why don't you use your powers?"
Yeah.
I love that. And he's like, what? He goes, nothing.
So cutting to the chase, basically, it ends up with, I don't want to skip too far ahead, but Joker and Onomatopoeia end up doing, as they keep recalling it, the ultimate supervillain team up.
Yes.
actually, that second issue was just full of great little character moments like that. That is where where Alfred and Batman are having these great exchanges in the Batcave.
Oh, we also have Joker pulling out his big hammer again. And there's also that wonderful line from Batman where he goes, God, I hate that hammer.
it's a great scene where Zeus is in bed with three vixens. And in a great series of panels, there's like, all the women's hands rubbing all over his body, and the next thing you just see Batman's hand come into frame, grabs him out of the bed and injects him full of antipsychotics to have a rational conversation with him. It's a wonderful thing, but it's also very dark in parts. Like, the scenes that do cut back to Onomatopoeia, he murders a prostitute during that scene, but then the setup is basically that Batman uses his knowledge of Joker to lure Onomatopoeia out to the open. But there's a really, really great line in that thing where Batman's summing up his knowledge of the Joker. It's a doctor at Arkham once described from the Joker's state of mind. Imagine trying to solve the world's most difficult math equation while you're surrounded by six televisions that sit 5 inches from your face, all tuned to different stations, all rapidly switching channels, and all with the volume at full blast. That's what it's like to be the Joker.
Yes.
Which I really love, and I don't think anyone's ever said it that way.
No, I think it really has nailed for me my ultimate Joker. I like that. It's the same thing that Mark Hamill kind of brought to the animated series, which was that.
It's funny. I could hear his voice when I was reading this Joker.
Yeah, because he's got that kind of absolute chaoticness that goes through it. The problem that, especially like the old 66 series on TV, Joker was too planned. It was too staged. Managed, yes. You know what I mean? Whereas I think the whole idea of when Heath Ledger played it with the fact that his makeup kept falling off and he was just he was mad, you know? And I love that complete insanity of it. I love the fact that he parachutes in on the roof. It's like, I just love the fact that he's just laughing and smiling the whole time he's coming down. it's that craziness that I love. And I think the fact that the art style that they chose for this, how everybody else looks relatively normal, but Joker is so extremified, actually really works for this book. Now, I got to say, the first few panels really threw me when I first started reading. I'm going, what have they done to him, you know?
Yeah.
But it really works for him. They really needed it.
The art style does change up as well, particularly by the time you get to the third issue, where it all gets a little bit darker. And I'm looking at the third issue now, and the art style for the Joker does start then to match the rest of the people, because it is... very much that third issue is about Onomatopoeia, But it's also very much about the Batman and Joker's relationship. Mm. And what they both mean to each other and why they need each other. Mm. Or in the case, as we find out, maybe don't need each other.
And I think that's one of the big revelations, finally, at the end. But we'll come back to that in a second, because that's actually right at the end. I think the most dramatic part of this book, aside from the big resolution scene in the hospital, but I think one of the big dramatic moments for me in this is the scene with Commissioner Gordon.
Absolutely. To go back a bit, Onomatopoeia has stabbed Joker through the heart.
Hmm.
So he's dying, and Batman's decided he's going to save him.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting moment in the book because Batman won't kill anybody, but he doesn't have to save people. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And I love the fact that Gordon comes out on the roof and Batman explains it. He says he nicked his heart, Jim, left ventricle. Mm. And at that point, you kind of see Gordon look at him and go, everybody stand down. He sends all his men away and then basically looks at Batman and just goes, are you crazy? Let him die.
And it basically says, I can't. It was my fault. I it was my idea to use him as bait. I got him stabbed. And Gordon just says, good.
And it's like, because it comes down to this. After all of this time, and then there's a beautiful panel which has the shot from The Killing Joke where he's shooting Gordon's daughter and the killing of Robin. And you sit there and go, why would you save this lunatic?
Mm.
And there's this strange relationship between Batman and Joker that just hasn't reached resolution and Batman can't let it go.
And Gordon says, I know you live by a code and I'd never ask you to break it, but I'm not asking you to kill him. I'm just asking you not to save him.
Hmm.
And then Jim just actually says, let him go.
Yeah, like it says, do the right thing here. For Gotham's sake, for your sake, let him go. And then we're left on that rooftop and you're left wondering what the decision was. Until the next page.
5 months later.
5 months later, and of course, Joker was saved. He was taken into hospital. And this is one of the great reveals, because Joker's reading the book again.
Still trying to get to Fountainhead.
Still trying to read Fountainhead.
He actually says, I'm never going to finish this book.
And
I'd love to see a follow-up series where he's still reading
it. Where he's still reading it. And when he finally pulls the book away, and he's got that big black beard.
Yeah.
And he said, now there's a Joker you've never seen before. Green hair, pale face, everything else, but a big black beard.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that he sees straight through the lawyer's disguise, which of course is really Bruce Wayne. Mm. They know each other so well.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that Joker says, go change into your real clothes because I'm having trouble, talking to you, looking like that. And of course he goes off and becomes Batman.
And I love the line. He says, and I saw a little bit of your junk while you were changing.
Even laying in the bed, even after 5 months, he's still nuts. Even under medication, because they've actually got him dosed up now. So he's actually lucid. And
which is why Batman's come to see him.
That's right. He says, while you're lucid, while you're here, while you're under control. And he just says, I need to ask you a question. He says, do you really want me dead? And I think that's a really important question for these two.
But Joker, of course, being Joker, turns it back on Bruce immediately.
Yeah, that's right. And he says, I don't know, let me roll it over a little bit. And he goes, meantime, same question applies to you, Spooky. You want to see me dead? And I love it because it's basically a trick. Because Batman then goes on with this whole thing about saying, I'm okay with you dying or getting killed, so long as it wasn't by my hands. And he goes through this whole long spiel.
Mm. And he basically ends with, it's all because I never want to see death firsthand again.
That's right. And we get through all of that. And then Joker says, interesting, I always thought your misguided sense of self-righteousness came from some personal tragedy, blah, blah, blah. And Batman goes, but I do want to kill you. I just think, after all of that, it just comes down to the fact he goes, yeah, I do want to kill you.
And I love this line as well, but here's the cold, hard truth, Bats. I don't hate you because I'm crazy. I'm crazy because I hate you.
Yes. And that's a nice piece of writing.
Yeah. Now, and which always comes back to the idea that is, does the presence of Batman create these other monsters?
Well, and that's the age-old argument of superheroes, isn't it?
Mm.
The fact that there's actually a line at the end of Dark Knight where Jim says, your presence escalates things.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like the concept in England where the police try not to carry guns because that way the bad guys won't carry guns. You know what I mean? Mm. It doesn't always work.
No.
But, you know, the more heavily, what is it in The Untouchables? You know, the Chicago way, they bring a knife, you bring a gun. You know what I mean? Escalate it constantly.
And I love this here as well. And your death, preferably not necessarily, but by my hand, will mean an end to the reign of terror, to my reign of terror in Gotham. When you're gone, I'll stop hurting people. So when you're gone, I'll stop hurting people. I don't know. I'll stop with the murder and mayhem. And then he, you know, sort of goes on and says, "Yes, I want to kill you." And then we'll both finally be free.
Mm.
Now that's probably the most telling conversation that you will ever have in a Batman comic, I think.
Yeah, I think it really sums up. I think it, in the space of two pages, Kevin Smith has distilled down a relationship of what, the last 40 years, 50 years?
Yeah. But then he, there's a beat, and then the next panel. Since we're both being super truthful, I should also tell you I saw a little bit of your junk when you were getting changed before. Which the joke carries on. And the next thing, when Alfred says, "Well, I can't say I'm surprised by what the Joker said, Master Bruce. It's a little wonder that he caught a glimpse, considering you wear your briefs on the outside of your clothes."
And Bruce just goes, "Funny." Yeah.
He goes, "Well, I always dreamed of being a nightclub comic." And so did he.
I love that. And Bruce now realizes, because he says in that last panel, he says, "The clown's not going to stop till one of us is dead."
Mm.
You know, and it's just... And I love the fact Alfred says, "Certainly this comes as no shock." You know, it's like, so I think we've come to a rousing conclusion to the Batman Joker arc, because we now sit there and go, now it's just basically a slugging match.
Yeah.
And
they should reference that throughout it. So it's like, you know, it's the same Joker's old move. We're just going through the motions here. When's this going to end? And the answer is when one of them's dead.
Hmm.
You know, now I actually, that's not the end of the comic though.
It's the end of the main story, which I think is, it's a really nice conclusion, but then there's this little epilogue.
Now, I've just noticed something in this little epilogue. Now, it's this man returning home, and the house number, I've only just noticed, is number 37.
Yeah.
Which is a nice, if you're a Kevin Smith fan, you'll know that the number 37 has been a meme throughout almost everything he's done since Clerks.
Never occurred to me until you just mentioned it here.
I only just noticed it there. And he's got a 37 in almost everything he does. And if you've seen Clerks, all I need to say is 37. So this is what I really like. And with the narration, and this is about Onomatopoeia, they're sort of wondering, well, where's he gone to? Because he kind of got lost in the...
Well, he jumped off the building top, didn't he?
Yeah, but we sort of lost his thing. In the 5 months later narrative, we've kind of forgotten about what happened in Onomatopoeia. But Kevin Smith's not going to let us forget. He says, where does he go when he's not hunting heroes? Who are his confidants, his henchmen? Does he maintain dual identities? And if he does, how does he live above suspicion? Now, the thing I really like about this is it seems to be a man returning home, and he's got a broken arm. And he's showing his wife a broken tennis racket or something, a squash racket. So, yep, that's how he did it.
Yep.
And so things go on, and he goes down to his basement. House,
two kids,
a dog.
Yeah, a little funny dog.
And he seems to just be wearing like a knitted vest and slacks. You know, he seems to be a very ordinary sort of guy. And he goes down into his basement where there's Easter decorations, Halloween decorations, etc., all neatly filed away. And then he puts the broken and the tattered and bloodied onomatopoeia mask on a mannequin, and you see, and Batman's narration says, "Does he know that there's no place he can hide from me?" And you see the masks of all the people that he's killed. There's an empty one there for Green Arrow too,
and Black Canary.
And what was that? And Black Canary.
Is that Black Canary? All you can see is the word black behind his head.
So you're assuming it's Black Canary. And then he's putting his latest empty case on the shelf, which is one for Batman.
Yeah, so he will strike again.
He will strike again. And I think that's a very telling thing about serial killers. And so it was really interesting. He's painted Onomatopoeia as a serial killer. And he's painted the Joker as just a psychotic clown, which is what he is. Now, as you said at the start of that, David, I think that's probably some of Smith's best writing.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I'm currently reading the new Dynamite series of The Bionic Man.
Right.
Which is based on the screenplay that he wrote for a feature film. And I'm actually quite enjoying that, but it's not far enough along yet to really find out the structure of the story. What I love about Cacophony is that it is literally a miniseries. And so he has a beginning, a middle, and an end, but allows it with enough loose ends that he can come back and add more to this.
Now, probably the only weakness I had with this is that it is a standalone series, but this character was introduced in the Green Arrow book. It's part of the main continuity as part of his rogues gallery. Now, at the end of that, Green Arrow swore revenge because he had almost killed Green Arrow's son. He put a bullet through his head. I would have thought Batman, at a professional courtesy, would have said, "Ollie, come, let's go get this guy."
Although I think it's really funny. There's a scene in issue two where you mentioned it, where Batman's in the Batcave with Alfred, and there's one point where he's talking about the fact that this guy went after.
That's right, and he says he almost killed Green Arrow's son. He goes, "This is why I think it's a bad idea
for people to carry on." That's right.
Yeah, people to carry on the mantle. And he makes a comment, says, "I'll be sure to tell, what's his name, Jean, the guy that was took over as briefly, I think, during the whole Broken Bat saga. What was his name?
I'm not sure. I'm just checking it out now. Very hard. I actually closed the page. So, here we are. Jean-Paul Valley.
Jean-Paul Valley, yeah. So I think he took over during the whole saga of Bane breaking the bat. This guy briefly took over as Batman, I believe. And I think there was a reference to that in there as well. But of course, subsequent to Smith writing this, somebody else has taken over the mantle of Batman in the main books when Bruce Wayne went missing for a while.
Well, I mean, Dick Grayson even did it for a while.
So what was that?
Dick Grayson, exactly, right.
So, it's interesting, though, because it's sort of touching on that idea of Batman as a symbol, you know, that Batman will carry on regardless. But then this book is very much about, no, it's about two men who have something to prove. And Batman ceases to become a symbol then, but it's almost as though this is now, after all these years, Batman's own personal vendetta. Whether he wants it to be or not, you know, he's sort of gotten to a point where he's almost blurring a line between it being justice and revenge.
The Joker's always been kind of a personal vendetta with Batman, though.
Mm.
It's always been that personal.
Batman, the Joker has been, but the bigger question is, where does it end for Batman once he kills the Joker? Does he keep going?
No, and see, I think that's the interesting point there, which is that the Joker says that if Batman is dead, he stops. But Batman wouldn't stop if Joker was dead, because Batman would just see that as another one down.
Absolutely.
You know, so I think that it's definitely an unbalanced relationship, if you think you put it that way.
Well, I think actually Alfred says at one point something about if he wouldn't know what to do if he got rid of all the psychos, and he said something along the lines of the muggers and pickpockets of Gotham City be warned, you know, for once all the psychos are gone, you know, what would Batman do? Would he go around solving petty crimes for the rest of his life?
Yeah, well, exactly. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, what Bruce Wayne has never really made it clear as to where the end game is.
No.
And I don't even think he knows where the end game is. I guess in the New 52, they're kind of broaching the subject a little bit with the whole idea that he's trying to restore Gotham. Rejuvenate it and change Gotham. So maybe that's the new endgame.
Yeah, because in the New 52, he's kind of using both of his identities to further Gotham. That's right. He's using Bruce Wayne to be the public face of Gotham's restoration, and while Batman works at night to clean up the messes that nobody else wants to touch.
And it really does make you wonder when he sleeps.
Apparently not. But they make a few references to that. He gets a few hours of sleep a day.
Mm.
But I don't think that's humanly possible to keep going on like that.
Especially at that sort of peak level of physical fitness.
Absolutely.
It's a good thing he's only a cartoon character.
which is what I really loved in the first Christopher Nolan Batman film in Batman Begins, is that there's a scene where he wakes up at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
And Alfred says, "We need to start making some excuses for why you sleep so late." Yeah, exactly. I love that. Well, Richard, all in all, I think it is a great series.
And absolutely.
I really, really highly recommend it to people. I think if you get a chance to read Batman Cacophony, Nicholas is giving a big thumbs up. He really enjoyed it as well. I will also
say it's fun for all ages.
It is. Some of the humor may go over some of the heads of some of the smaller people, but I will also have to say that if you want to giggle, Kevin Smith has a podcast called Hollywood Babylon. And a few months back, they did an episode called Comic-Con Theater. And him and Ralph Garman actually read the first issue of Cacophony. And Ralph Garman did it in character voices. And so he did Batman as Adam West, and he did Joker as
Edwin.
Joker was Edwin.
Edwin.
And it fit really well.
I can imagine.
It was very, Maxie Zeus was done as Al Pacino. And right. It was a very, very funny episode. And apparently they're coming back to do it again in the next couple of weeks. So if you go and subscribe for free to Hollywood Babylon and have a listen and look for the Comic-Con Theater, it's a very funny listen. Because the Edwin voice is perfect for Joker. I believe they're doing issue 2 of Cacophony for the next Comic-Con Theater.
Oh, fantastic.
So hopefully by the end they'll have done all three of them and we'll have those to treasure because Ralph Garman is very, very funny.
And I was going to say, if you want to check out any more of Kevin Smith's comic work, I highly recommend his Daredevil run.
Yes.
Which is really, really good.
All full of Catholic angst.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's as a lapsed Catholic myself, I think it's fantastic. And he also does it. He and the same creative team, so he and Walt Flanagan have done a second miniseries called The Widening Gaia, and or Gear, possibly. I always mispronounce that. It's one or the other. It's possibly both acceptable pronunciations. And it's so far, it's a 6-issue miniseries of an intended 12, and he's only done half of them.
It's not one of those series again where he's going to be really late with everything, is he?
Probably. No, I think he decided it was going to be 12, but he'd do 6 issues and then come back and do the other 6 later because rather than committing to a 12-issue series. It's quite good. It's a very different story, and it's focuses less on the Joker relationship. So it's more of a more of your sort of old-fashioned detective story, but it's Batman starts having meeting up with this new crime fighter who seems to be helping out Batman. Like whenever he gets into a bad scrape, he seems to be there and having his back, and seems to follow the same code that Batman does. And Batman's not quite sure whether to trust him, but he's slowly letting himself trust this guy while he's slowly also letting himself fall in love with Silver St. Cloud, this former flame that has come back into his life. And these two things, and it's kind of like almost Batman starting, Bruce Wayne is starting to ease off a little bit.
It'd be interesting to see if Kevin Smith actually comes in and writes anything for the New 52.
It'd be interesting, but I think he's preferring to do the mini series for two reasons. He has the freedom to do what he wants outside of the
main timeline, yeah.
Yeah, outside of the main thing, and he can't mess anything up. That way he can't mess up continuity, but also he's not on as strict a monthly schedule.
The other thing is, if you want to catch up with some of his slightly more, it's more of his independent stuff, is Dynamite recently put out his 10 issues of Green Hornet, which was based on the script of the film that he was going to make before it all fell apart. And then he turned it into a comic book. And that's kind of interesting to read just to see what the Green Hornet could have been.
That's quite good as well. Yeah, even if you go back and get any of the stuff that he did spin off from his Skewniverse stuff as well.
Mm. And also, as I said, now he's doing The Bionic Man, which once again is based on his script for a reboot of The Bionic Man, the $6 million man that he was planning to do and, of course, fell apart. So he's turned it into a comic book again. And that's actually really, really interesting. 3 issues in, I'm really enjoying that. So we'll see where that goes. But, Richard, we are out of time. We're actually over time, I must say.
Oh, my God.
We are way over time. We should probably finish this up. Because we normally go for an hour, and I think we can go for an hour 20 minutes. So
okay, so look, we got into a really good book this week, and something we both enjoyed talking about.
Absolutely, and it's going to happen every now and again. We're going to go over time. What are we doing next week? Now,
let's just throw it down then. Let's say I'm going to have a quick look at the list and choose one at random.
Oh, okay, that's one way of doing it.
Let's just do it that way.
Let's have a look at where is the list here. Hold on a second. The list is here. It's here.
And we should remind readers that if you do have a preference, you do have something, readers/listeners, if you do have a preference of something that you would like us to discuss on Behind the Panels, please send us an email, comics@geekactually.com.
Absolutely. What are you pointing at? Oh, Nikki's pointing at random. Do you know what I would like to do, but I don't want to do it next week because we just did a Batman title, which is I really want to do Batman Year One at some point.
Yeah, no, definitely. Let's do should we switch back to Marvel or should we do a Superman?
Actually, do you know what I want to do? I think we should do we could either do a Superman or we could do the Ultimates.
Let's do the Ultimates. We'll do the first series of the Ultimates.
First season then. Of the first volume of the Ultimates.
12 or 13 issues, whatever it was.
It's less than that, actually, I think. I think it's actually going to be quite a manageable read. Let's just find
excellent.
It here. Ultimates. Give me a second. I will tell you. Ultimates 1. Oh, no. It's 13 issues.
13 issues. There you go. We can still do that. It's manageable.
It's a pretty fast 13 issues.
We've both read it before, so we can skim read.
We can skim read. It's interesting to look at the Ultimates because it is a completely sandboxed alternate universe.
Absolutely. And it'll tie in well because we're building up towards the Avengers in, about 6 months' time.
Yeah, about May, I think. The Ultimates is interesting because basically people die right, left, and center that you don't expect to die. Because
and Ant-Man's a bastard.
Ant-Man is a bastard, absolutely. All right, so we'll do the Ultimates Volume 1. So Ultimates 1 for next week. So if you can get hold of a copy of that, that'll be great. And you can then follow along with us. If you have comments, criticisms, and so forth, as Richard said before, the email address is comics@geekactually.com. Or we have a voicemail line as well. You could actually, we'd like to play your voicemails on air if you want to send them through. 02-801-13167 is that number. Which is our Geek Actually line. So just make sure you try and keep those a little bit short, though. 1 minute tops. Richard, we forgot to do it last week. We had to tack it on the end. Where can people find more of you on the internet?
You can find me on my film website, but I also deal with comic things as well. You can find me at therealbits.com. That's RELBits.com. And also on Twitter at DVDBits.
Fantastic. And you can find everything about me just by going to geekactually.com. Find out about the other podcasts we do and all sorts of other stuff. Follow all my links for Twitter and everything are all at geekactually.com. But I will also let you know that I am on Twitter at David McVay, all one word. David McVay, and you can always send me tweets there. That's it. I think we're done.
Excellent.
And we will come back for next week and the Ultimates. Sounds good to me.
Sounds excellent. We're going to get reading.
All right. See you next week, Richard.
See you then, David.
Bye, everybody.